From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the other man from Uncle, we talk with David McCallum, who co-starred in the 60s spy series as Ilya Kuryakin. You can see him now in the new film Hear My Song. Also today, the civil rights movement as seen through the eyes of a 12-year-old girl. We talk with Talani Davis about her semi-autobiographical novel, 1959, about a girl chosen to help desegregate a white school. And The Hand That Rocks the Cradle. Film critic Stephen Schiff considers the common fears this hit film is playing on. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Tomorrow, the Bush administration will defend its plan to return Haitian boat people to their own country. Lawyers for the Haitians say they're fleeing persecution. The U.S. government says they left home for economic rather than political reasons and that there's no evidence that returnees have been persecuted. NPR's Alan Tomlinson was one of two U.S. reporters who were detained yesterday in a remote area of northern Haiti. He says he saw direct evidence of persecution and reprisals.
We found that 121 houses had been burned. The entire system of repression that existed before Aristide has been replaced in the countryside. And what they call the section chiefs, the country's divided into 600 sections, and each section is run like a little fiefdom, and also a fiefdom by the local enforcers. And they come in and burn down this village and extorted money from the peasants, and it was quite clear from what they told us that this was a reprisal for their persistence in supporting the ousted president.
Tomlinson said that he and his companion, Chicago Tribune reporter Nat Shepard, were threatened with death by one of the section chiefs, but that they were finally turned over to the Haitian army. Russian President Boris Yeltsin has given his outspoken vice president, Alexander Rutskoy, the job of reforming Russia's troubled agricultural sector. The BBC's Tim Huell reports from Moscow that the appointment may be an effort to neutralize an increasingly outspoken rival.
Mr. Yeltsin's announcement of the vice president's new responsibilities drew mocking laughter from many deputies. Agriculture is widely regarded as the sector of the economy where reform is hardest to achieve. And in the past, the portfolio has sometimes been given to politicians out of favour with the Kremlin leadership. Mr. Yeltsin insists the overall success of his market reforms depends on fostering a new class of private farmers. So far, the reform is proceeding slowly because of bureaucratic opposition and because private farmers often lack the equipment, animal feed and trading networks they need to operate effectively. Mr. Yeltsin told Parliament that at his meeting with Mr. Rutskoy, the two men had shown understanding of each other's positions. But the tone of his remarks suggested a less than fully respectful attitude towards his deputy. He said Mr. Rutskoy should report back to him every 2 weeks and to Parliament every month.
Tim Huell in Moscow. Stock prices fell sharply today on Wall Street despite some better-than-expected statistics on retail sales and new unemployment claims. Analysts said that the good news may have reduced the odds that the Federal Reserve will act soon to cut interest rates. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 30 points to close at 3,246.65. Declines led advances by nearly 2-1. This is NPR. The Commerce Department reported today that retail sales were up last month by 0.6%. The revised figures from December were better, too, showing a 0.1% gain instead of a 0.4% decline. January's improvement in sales was the strongest monthly rise since May of last year, and it was far higher than most analysts had been expecting. The report said that the upsurge represented a growth in demand for products ranging from cars to building materials. The gain was led by a burst of activity at department stores. Widely scattered showers, some of them heavy, dumped more rain on Southern California early today as the latest in a series of storms moved out of the area. At least 6 people have been killed and a few more are still missing. From Los Angeles, NPR's Wendy Kaufman reports.
The sun emerged at least briefly today, and many Southern California residents took advantage of the relatively dry weather to dig out from the water, mud, and landslides that have accompanied this week's intense storms. At the same time, residents were getting ready for the next big storm, expected to arrive late Friday or early Saturday. After that, however, forecasters see more normal, drier conditions. Weather experts speculate that the unusually wet weather has been caused by El Niño, a warming of the ocean in the eastern Pacific. Among other things, the jet stream has been pushed farther south than usual, opening the way for storms from the Pacific that would usually fall much farther north. In Los Angeles, this is Wendy Kaufman reporting.
New claims for unemployment benefits fell by 13,000 during the final week of January. The Labor Department reported that the number of out-of-work Americans who filed first-time claims that week was 437,000, down for the second week in a row. The drop came as a surprise to some economists who'd been predicting a small increase. Nevertheless, analysts said that the unemployment rate is likely to get worse in the coming months, reflecting continuing weakness in the economy. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Sometimes you have a favorite actor from an old TV series who you've lost track of, and you're delighted when you start seeing them again on TV or in films. As an old David McCallum fan, I was pleased to see him in the new film Hear My Song. I remember him as Ilya Kuryakin, the Soviet agent in The Man from U.N.C.L.E., the mid-60s spy series. Remember what U.N.C.L.E. stood for? The United Network Command for Law and Enforcement. Well, I had to look it up. Anyways, McCallum has spent most of the intervening years in theater, but recently he co-starred with Diana Rigg in the British TV series Mother Love, and he's currently starring with Susanna York in the BBC series Trainer. The new comedy, Hear My Song, is loosely based on the true story of Joseph Locke, a celebrated Irish tenor who left England in the 50s to avoid arrest for tax evasion. McCallum is the bad guy constable, poised to arrest Locke the moment he returns. I asked McCallum how he got the part.
As they all do, a script came through the mail, and I sat on my bed reading it and laughing to myself. And my wife, Catherine, said, "What are you reading?" And I briefly explained the plot to her, and she said, "Well, you're not going to do that, are you?" And I said, "Yes, this is a script which I don't care what it is. I have to do this film." And she said, "Well, are they paying any money?" I said, "No, not at all." Do you have to pay your own fare while?" And I said, "Yes, probably." But I said, "There is such charm and such wit, and if this film, if the director can transpose what's here on the page onto the screen, this is going to be a wonderful film."
So did you have to pay your own fare to shoot the
Probably,
movie?
Yes. No, I was actually working on another film at the same time, so I managed to put the two together. But the budget on Hear My Song, in these days of, I read budgets in the New York Times and what they're grossing, and it's just awesome, this, you know, $60, $70, $80 million to make one picture. And Hear My Song, of course, was made for about $4 million. And there it is up competing with all the others.
Yes, and they're talking Academy Awards.
Yes, isn't it sweet? It would be so nice because the guys that did it are so wonderful and enthusiastic and young and immature in so many ways. I mean, they're in their 30s and all, and they're wild Irishmen drinking Guinness by the pint. Or more than that, but it would be just super if something could happen along the lines. Just to get a nomination would be fabulous.
David McCallum, I have to ask you about The Man from U.N.C.L.E., the series that you co-starred in from 1964 to 68. And in asking you about it, I have to confess that I had a real crush on you. I was probably one of, like, millions of teenage girls. Was that annoying to you or fun or what, to know that there were all these teenage girls like myself out there who had crushes on you?
Well, you don't actually think about it that much at the time. You do, of course. But at the time I was doing The Man from U.N.C.L.E., my main concern was the script and the part and the day and the day's work and getting to the studio and going into MGM. And there was a magical element as far as I was concerned, because I'd been brought up in Europe, been brought up in London on Hollywood. And there I was driving a 57 Chevy down Sunset Boulevard with the top down in the sunshine and going to MGM to work. So I was quite overawed by what was happening to me, quite apart from what was happening to the show. When the show began and there was this adulation, that was very wonderful for me and also for the show, because again, they were concerned with ratings even in those days. And it was a great pleasure. Then after that, it became a bit dangerous because, like fans everywhere, there was an element of I don't know, madness about it all. And occasionally I couldn't go for a walk. I was rescued in Central Park by mounted policemen, and they destroyed two floors of Macy's. I think they did about $25,000 damage one day when I was there. So there was an element of things getting out of hand.
I want to hear more of what happened in Central Park.
Well, I just went. I think we were staying at the Plaza Hotel, and I walked down towards to look at the skaters. And I remember walking across the park, and there was no problem. And then somebody said, "Oh, look, there's Ilya," or some such phrase, and came running over. And then some more did. And then finally, there was a very large crowd of people around me. It just got to the point where I couldn't move. And mercifully, two of New York's finest came by on horses, and one of them actually picked me up. And I hung to on the saddle, and he just eased me out and back to the plaza. But it was a moment that I hadn't really encountered up to that time, of completely losing your private identity in that kind of situation.
Well, this was the period, too, in the mid-60s, that the Beatles were very, very popular in the States, and teenage girls would go to their movies and their concerts and just scream. Were you exposed to that kind of screaming?
Yes, occasionally. I mean, it was all set up. MGM, Chuck Painter was the publicist, and he made a very definite schedule for us when we would go off and do various public appearances. And they would be announced ahead of time, and we'd be there, and they would scream. And that was all part of the job in many ways.
What kind of stuff did the PR department crank out to satisfy your fans?
Well, it's fascinating because if you go back, I have interviews sometimes, you know, the Daily Telegraph in England recently did a piece on me, and she went back to the cuttings and got out this file. And it was fascinating because during that time, there were so many requests for interviews and so many requests for stories that Chuck and his minions, mainly Chuck himself, would actually sit down and write stories about Bob and about me. And those would go out verbatim as if he'd actually interviewed us. And most of it is fact. But then an awful lot was made up.
Like what?
I remember there was one article appeared, I think, in the National Enquirer when Catherine and I were very first married, about me coming home into the apartment and flinging my lean frame down into a chair and demanding my usual scotch and soda, which Catherine brought to me, wearing her skimpy bikini and all this. And, you know, although you can't do anything about those stories. And in a way, there was another one, not in the same publication, about me going down to the garage, selecting from my 8 cars and describing each one. And these things, of course, after a while, get picked up by other places. And all of this misinformation finally ends up in the most wonderful stories. And it's very amusing.
Did Robert Vaughan have the same kind of fans that you did?
Not the same kind. We had two distinctly separate groups of fans.
What were the differences between your two groups of fans?
I have no idea. I have absolutely no idea. I mean, I've never been in a situation to compare them. In a way, it's nice that there's a... From that day, some of the fans formed what they call the McCallum Observer, which is a lady out in Indiana, or is it Illinois? They sort of keep a fan club going where they all meet and talk and swap stories and various memorabilia and paraphernalia, which gets more and more expensive.
How did you get the part on The Man from U.N.C.L.E.?
Well, I came over to this country when Britain went socialist. I decided that I did not wish to live in a country where socialism does all the things that it does to people's incomes and earning power. And here I was. I burned my boats. I had no home in London. Jill came with me. And there we were. We took a little house at the arranged by Paul Kona. And when I finished doing the job that I came over for, which was to do the greatest story ever told, playing Judas Iscariot of all people, I decided that it was the right thing to do and we were going to stay. And for a while did nothing. Then I got one or two jobs. The case of the 10 millionth Frenchman episode of Perry Mason. And then various other things, playing Redcoats, of course, because I was very British, and there I would play Redcoats. And then I was one day at the... we were very friendly with Charles Bronson, and still are, and Charlie took me down to the commissary at MGM. And Norman Felton, who was British and who had done a number of series at that time running Dr. Kildare, was looking for somebody to play Bob Vaughan's sidekick in this thing at that moment known as Mr. Solo. And there were a couple of lines in the pilot, and Ilya Koryakin had some jazz records under his bed. That's the only thing I remember about it. And I agreed to do it. And the same day, I was offered a series playing Judas Iscariot and another one doing Alexander the Great, which was fascinating because I didn't realize that these sort of things came always on the same day.
Weren't you a Russian defector in The Man from U.N.C.L.E.?
No, I was a Russian working for, well, NBC, basically. There was no real discussion as to whether he defected or not. It was an organization that allowed people to work who were Russian and who were American, which was a unique idea in itself. But there was no question of defection. There was one line in it about my education being at the University of Georgia, which I left because I thought it was, you know, it was sufficiently enigmatic. But his background and actually what happened is what Look magazine called A Climate of Negatives, I think it was. But what I did in the beginning was, because I wasn't sure about what he was or where he came from, when anybody wrote in a script a specific about a marriage, about a son, about a child, about a job, I would take it out or I would quote Shelley or Keats in order to avoid the question. So in all 100 shows or whatever we did of Ilya Koryakin, there is nothing anywhere that pins him down to anything specific.
That's interesting. Did you feel like the show helped help promote the Cold War?
I think because the Vietnam War at that time was causing terrible anguish in this country, and it was when the newsreels were beginning to become less censored, and there was the sort of whole violent reaction to it, particularly among the young people, particularly among people in college and in school, that this was, in a strange way, a relief. It was like saying it's possible for Russians and Americans to work together, it's possible for there to be no Cold War. And I think that had partly to do with the success. I think, you know, it's always, timing is always very important. And I think the show coming out at that time, Vietnam definitely had a bearing on it. Because an awful lot of people that come to me now and say, you know, I grew up with you, I went through college with you, that's the line I hear more. And particularly policemen and undercover agents, they say, the reason I joined this profession was because of you.
Really? Huh.
So I think the formative years at that time, it had an effect on a whole group of people.
Have you ever been to Russia, and do you know if The Man from U.N.C.L.E. ever ran there?
No to both questions, but I've been to East Germany. And I remember it was still with heavy Cold War feelings around. And I went through Checkpoint Charlie, and I noticed that every Vopo on the other side had these enormous lenses and was taking pictures. And I wondered about it at the time, but then I discovered they do it to practically everybody and they keep enormous files. And so, no, I have no idea. I believe that Pravda at one point wrote an editorial belittling American television and particularly picked out U.N.C.L.E. and particularly picked out me as a misrepresentation of the Russian spirit.
Hmm. How'd you feel about that?
Oh, wonderful. I mean, great to make Pravda. I'm still here.
What was it like for you after the series ended when you tried to get other roles on TV or in films?
Well, it was difficult. It was a very difficult situation, very difficult time and a problem, and I didn't know quite how to deal with it. My reaction was to say, well, I've now become so well known as Ilya Koryakin that if I go away from it and stay away from it, it'll go away. And so I just decided to not do television. And I moved to New York, and I did a lot of theater, and I worked back in England. And I would do the odd Hallmark or the odd special, but I basically stayed out of television. It was completely the wrong thing to do in many ways, because I think if I'd stayed in Los Angeles and stayed in Hollywood, I would have gone on to do a great deal more television and had a different career. In a way, I prefer the one I've got, but it's interesting to surmise what might have happened.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is actor David McCallum. He co-stars in the new movie Hear My Song, and you might have also seen him recently on the British TV series Mother Love with Diana Rigg, and you probably know him as Ilya Koryakin from The Man from U.N.C.L.E. I'm going to take a short break, and we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. We'll be right back. Actor David McCallum is my guest. Now, you were a child actor on the BBC. Your television career dates back that far?
Yes. I think I joined Equity in 1946, so I'd be about 12.
How did you get into TV at such a young age?
Well, I suppose it goes back to the relationship that a child has with his father and mother. And my father, being a musician, he was with Sir Thomas Beecham at the time and the London Philharmonic Orchestra. And he was always away, and I didn't really have a definitive father figure in that we went to ball games and knocked about in the back garden. My mother was of the belief that you leave a child to do exactly what he wants to do, give him total support and structure, but just let them get on with it. And so I was looking for an identity, and one day I went onto a stage as an amateur actor and gave a performance, and everybody applauded. And I realized that I'd found something that was, like a home to come back to. And so I pursued that. And I've never done anything else since. At the same time, my father was working at the BBC a great deal. And he introduced me to Laidman Brown, who was an actor with the BBC Repertory Company. And they needed boy voices. And specifically, they needed boy voices who could also do accents. And I could do most of the Scottish accents at that time, and quite a lot of English ones, too. And so I worked on radio, and that's really my first professional engagement.
I think in the United States, a lot of actors who were child stars are now in therapy. Did any of the child acting have a bad effect on you, or did it not have the kind of exposure and pressure that would lead to despair in later life?
No, the only despair was my headmaster at University College School in London, because he felt that my mind was really over in the thespian world and not in Latin and Greek, where he preferred it be. And so my report card would always make comments about this, does well but could do better, and the reason is probably because of his acting. But other than that, he eventually ended up hanging himself in his study, and rather dramatically. And I went on to act. We did have one or two confrontations on the subject of the interpretation of Shakespeare, and I think he lost those too. But other than that, no, I don't think it had any real bearing.
No, I've read about you that you also directed theater in the British Army.
Yes, you've been in the cutting book. You're dredging up those way back things. Yes, I did. I was a very bad soldier. I was very happy to be in the army because it taught me how to be a soldier any time I had to do it as an actor. And I learned a great deal about the British colonial empire because I went to what is now Ghana when it was Gold Coast, and I joined the C Company of the 3rd Battalion of the Gold Coast Regiment. And I had a silver sword, and I had feathers in my hat, and I had a boy who was about 45, I think, Tamale Kanjaga, who looked after me. And as a young subaltern, I marched up and down the Gold Coast, you know, pretending I was a representative of the British Empire and all that. Anyway, during that time, Gold Coast became Ghana, and there was a whole political upheavals with Kwame Nkrumah and all of that handing over. And it was very exciting and very interesting. But because I wasn't a very good soldier, there were various jobs that you did in the officer's mess. I'm sure it's the same in the British Army now. Somebody looked after the wine. Somebody did all the dinners and the cooking in the mess. Somebody else did the bar. Somebody else did the band. There was always one person assigned to do all these tedious chores that nobody wanted to do. So I went to the commanding officer and said, listen, can I do all of those jobs and not, you know, parade around and be a soldier? And he was so relieved to find somebody who was willing to do them that I became a sort of glorified maitre d' of the regiment. And one of the things that they did, they had various dances, and so I would take a large aeroplane hangar and fill it with palm fronds and drape bougainvillea from the ceiling and just turn it into a sort of an enchanting sort of fairyland. And this caught on, and then the next thing was there were the various productions that the army did. The medical corps did some, the signal corps, and they would call me in to direct, and I would direct plays with, you know, soldiers and soldiers' wives, and it was a great pleasure and a great learning experience.
So do you think that helped your theater training?
Oh, very much so, very much so. Just going off into the bush and doing things with, you know, there were 147 Africans, and then there was Captain Linley and myself, and that was it. Oh, and a color sergeant whose name was Bullet. I've no idea what he's now. Sergeant Coase, that's right, who had a... He looked like, I don't know, he looked like something out of Wagon Train and was quite wonderful, quite wonderful. And we had the experiences all through that time, all up into the... Towards Koforidua we went.
Now, your father was a violinist. He was a concertmaster for a while at the London Philharmonic.
Yes, and then worked with the BBC during the war, and then after the war when they reformed the Royal Philharmonic for Sir Thomas Beecham, and they asked our father to lead it, and he came along, and he stayed with the Royal Philharmonic right through until just before Beecham retired in, I suppose that's the 60s, early 60s. And then he became Mantovani's soloist and leader and traveled all over the world with the Mantovani band.
Yes, now Mantovani was the king of middle-of-the-road music. Oh,
absolutely, yes. You cringe. But, you know, I still in the car, I'm sitting there and I hear softly as you leave me or whatever, or Fiddler on the Roof and its father playing away. And he did a great deal of freelance work. He worked with the Beatles, which my children discovered and thought was quite wonderful.
Wasn't Mantovani the 1001 strings or 101
That's right.
strings?
That's
or
right.
However
that,
many
that
strings.
Sort of glissando, divise section work.
So did he like the music or was it just
a good gig?
He,
my father was, you know, one of the boys. He would go down and he'd sit there and play the music, pick up the check and come home. And no matter what he did, he was happy. He'd go do film music, he would do... you know, commercials, anything that came along. And oddly enough, one of the things that he did, there were a couple of what they called bookers or fixers who would get the band together. And one of them was a man called Phil Green, and he put together a band for a lot of singers. And when I heard I was going to do Hear My Song, I got out the tapes of Joseph Locke, as he is the subject of the film, and played them. And I thought, now, wait a minute, I recognize that violin. Because having, you know, my father's violin playing is like his voice. I can pick it out almost anywhere. And I looked at the tape, and surely enough, the bands were all by, Phil Green and various people that father worked for. And when I met Joe Locke, I said, was that my father? And he said, absolutely. My father did most of my recordings, and I remember him well.
That's really interesting.
Small world.
Is your father still living?
No, he died in 72.
I bet he would have really liked the idea of you doing this movie.
This movie and also Mother Love, because when I was conducting the BBC Symphony Orchestra in London, in the Westminster Hall, and so a lot of the musicians knew Father, and the principal violin said, what do you think? And I said, well, he's definitely here. He's definitely listening.
Are you hoping that your role in Hear My Song is going to give you a new direction in the kind of movies that you're cast in?
Yes, I would like to think so. Simply because, you know, before I did Uncle, I was a character actor in pictures. That was my job. And, it's a form of acting where you do any part that you're called on to do. So you alter what you do. When I did a play in London called Run for Your Wife, which was a farce, people would come along and say, I didn't know you could do comedy. And then people see hear my song and say, I didn't expect you to play that kind of part. This is really unusual for you, isn't it? But it wasn't in the beginning. I mean, in the beginning, that was what I did. I did what came along. And in a way, it would be really nice to go back and become an actor in motion pictures, playing character parts, no matter how small, because I think that's what I enjoy the most.
Well, I wish you the best, and I thank you a lot for talking with us. It's really been interesting to hear your story.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you.
David McCallum co-stars in the new movie Hear My Song, based on the story of Irish tenor Joseph Locke. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Count your blessings one by one. When dawn appears and the day has just begun.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. At the age of 12, Tulani Davis was chosen to be one of the first black students to integrate an all-white school. It's the inspiration behind her new novel, 1959. Coming up, we talk about growing up in the civil rights movement. It's only been 4 weeks since the thriller, The Hand That Rocks the Cradle, opened in theaters, but it's already made more than $50 million at the box office. Film critic Stephen Schiff looks at the reasons for its success. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. UN Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali has recommended that a peacekeeping force be sent to Yugoslavia within several weeks. These troops will be deployed to help stabilize the nation while peace talks take place. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
Boutros-Ghali has resisted sending troops to Yugoslavia until now because conditions were too dangerous. But since early January, a ceasefire has taken hold and virtually all sides have agreed to accept a UN presence. So Boutros-Ghali today decided to recommend a peacekeeping force. The force, which must be formally approved by the UN Security Council, will be one of the largest in UN history. It will consist of up to 13,000 personnel who will be deployed in three areas where Serbs and Croats have clashed. They will be charged with keeping tensions from reigniting and protecting civilians. The force will cost at least $400 million a year, money that will have to come from the UN's already overextended peacekeeping budget. The first troops could be in place within a little more than 2 weeks. In New York, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
In Algeria, fundamentalists say that they will stage a protest march tomorrow, despite a government ban under a state of emergency. Supporters of the Islamic Salvation Front, a group that the government is trying to ban, have spread word that the protest march will take place after weekly Friday prayers. Several top leaders of the front have been jailed since a crackdown last summer. Last Friday, street battles occurred in several cities as security forces tried to enforce curbs on large gatherings outside mosques. Officials in Germany have again demanded that former East German leader Erich Honecker be extradited from Russia. Honecker's health is reportedly getting worse. Deidre Berger reports from Frankfurt.
For 2 months, Erich Honecker has been holed up at the Chilean embassy in Moscow in hopes of avoiding deportation to Germany, where he's wanted on murder charges. Now, Chilean embassy staff reportedly want to transfer the 79-year-old to a hospital to treat his liver cancer. German Justice Minister Klaus Kinkel says he would accept treatment of Honecker in a Moscow hospital. But Kinkel has repeatedly warned his Russian colleagues not to let Honecker travel to a third country. Honecker is reportedly trying to join his family in Chile, although the Chilean government says it will not grant political asylum to the former communist leader. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Frankfurt.
The FCC has ruled that telephone companies must report service outages immediately if they affect 50,000 customers and last for 30 minutes or more. The FCC chairman says this move is one in a series of steps the commission is taking to guard against outages. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 30 points to close at 3,246. This is NPR News. Officials now say that at least 6 people have been killed by storms in Southern California. After days of rain, a new storm system is moving into the state. Recent flooding has carried off motorhomes and cars and put some 150 houses underwater. Storms have left up to 10 inches of rain over the last 5 days and knocked out power in some places. The governor has declared a state of emergency in Los Angeles and Ventura counties. Over 1 million school children are reportedly going without breakfast. According to a survey released today by the Food Research and Action Center, this is happening because public school officials don't think it's either important or feasible. NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports.
Of the 89,000 schools that participate in the federal government's National School Lunch Program, fewer than half offer breakfast, despite mounting evidence that more children today are going hungry. Marsha Jackson is a pediatric nurse.
A missed breakfast will cause headaches, dizziness, fatigue, stomach cramps. Hungry children cannot attend to the business of the day.
No less appalling, says Thomas O'Neill, a New Jersey businessman, were the reasons school officials gave for not offering a breakfast program.
Concerns about equipment, about transportation, about supervision, about cost became barriers. There was no effective advocate pushing the schools.
Which is why the Food Research and Action Center wants state officials to pressure local school administrators and Congress to double the funding for breakfast and lunch programs. The cost? $800 million. I'm Claudia Sanchez in Washington.
The Commerce Department says that sales at the retail level moved up last month, with stronger demand for a number of items, including new cars and building materials. The government says that last month's increase of 0.6% was the strongest since May of 1991. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. At the age of 12, Tulani Davis was chosen to be one of the black students to integrate a white school in Virginia. She was prepared for the experience by her father and her teacher, in vain as it turned out, because the integration plan never went through. But it was still the beginning of the end for segregation in Hampton, Virginia. That same year, several young black men sat down at a local Woolworth's lunch counter, and soon the blacks of the town were boycotting white businesses. These experiences are the inspiration for Davis's new novel, 1959. This is Tulani Davis's first novel. She used to write about African-American issues for the Village Voice. She also wrote the libretto for the opera X, The Life and Times of Malcolm X. The opera is about to be released on CD by Gramavision. I asked Davis how she felt about being chosen to integrate the school.
Real ambivalent. I think it was mostly frightening to me. I am actually glad I did not have that experience in the end. I think in black communities in that era, children grew up with a tremendous sense of responsibility drilled into them that, you know, you're a representative of the race and you must go forward and do well. We all had that. But the pressure that I think kids had on them who went to those schools, I think it could barely be shared with anyone else. I think it was a pretty isolating experience.
In your novel, the father at first really is opposed to sending his daughter to this white school to integrate, but then he realizes that it's for the benefit of the civil rights struggle, and he feels that the family has a responsibility to participate. What was the process that your father went through in thinking it out? Do you remember?
Well, my father was very unusual, and he did a lot of his thinking aloud in my presence. So I knew he had a lot of misgivings about it. He told me he was very frightened for me personally. That was his main misgiving about it. And at the same time, I think he was proud that they thought his kid could make it through something like that. He had had many experiences like that himself in his own life, so he had a good idea, I think, what it would be like and what it would take. And I think, like most parents, he wasn't sure that his children were as tough as he had had to be in his life, because most of us have had harder lives than our children or people younger than us. So I think, it gave him another sense of who I was, in a sense, by my being objectified by the other people who knew and dealt with me.
In the novel, Willie, the girl who's going to be one of the students integrating the schools, she's such the good student that one of the boys she knows basically accuses her of being a real goody-goody and a real debutante when she's not. Did you go through that kind of thing, too?
Well, I went through much worse. I didn't take it up in the book because I had so much to deal with. But I guess one of the things that made me who I am is that I really lived in an environment where even then, I mean, we hear a lot today about helping to shape young black males. But I lived in an environment where that was done as a practice of life. And I was a competitive being. I don't think I knew that then, but I was pretty competitive. And I used to like to beat the boys in quizzes and to, you know, prove myself to be the smartest kid in class. And I took some lumps for that. And I was occasionally asked to take second prize for things I had won in order to allow male students to be perceived to be in the leadership sort of position in the class. And that happened in other places other than the classroom. And it crushed me. It really did. It was one of those things I came home and took up with my father, because I didn't understand. My father had given me this fairly false notion that, you know, life is a meritocracy and you go out there, you do the work, you get ahead, you get acknowledged if you succeed on these objective forms of accomplishment, like tests and things like that, that they are not political. And so I learned at 10 or 11 that they were, in fact, political and subject to change. So I think by the time I came to college and in the black student movement at Columbia, I discovered women were stuffing envelopes. I'd had my fill of it, and several of us really just sort of burst out with, I guess, a lifetime of anger in the midst of the black student meeting starting in 66 at Columbia. We, as freshmen, came in there and raised a lot of hell because we'd had a lot of that.
I think for a lot of people of your generation, they started participating in protests and pickets and boycotts and so on when they were teenagers, older teenagers, 17, 18, 19, 16 maybe. But you started participating in demonstrations and boycotts when you were 12, which is pretty young. Mm-hmm. Were you ever really frightened, especially considering you were in the South, there might have been police dogs mm-hmm. at the demonstrations as there are in scenes in your novel?
No, I wasn't. I'll tell you, when I came to Barnard, most of the girls who came, black girls who came in that year, there were 19 of us, were from the South. And most of us had experienced that. I don't think in the South that my experience was unusual, because the primary organizational tool in the South was the church, and they brought children. And that was a practice fairly early in the movement. And I think most people probably experienced marches mm-hmm. and that sort of thing. I also didn't find it frightening because, one, there wasn't a lot of violence in my town, but there's a sense of sheltering in a crowd of people consisting of everyone you know, that you have a sense that whatever happens, it's okay, because this is everyone you've ever known your whole life, or almost, and it's not it doesn't feel as out of control as it felt for me in 1968 in New York City at a march against the war in Vietnam, where horses just charged us. I felt like I was going to get trampled and my father would never hear of me again. That was much more just anonymous and frightening, and the scope of it was quite large. Whereas in a southern town, you sort of know the faces you're looking at.
If you're just joining us, my guest is writer Talani Davis. Her new novel, 1959, is about the early days of desegregation, and it's told through the eyes of a 12-year-old girl. We're going to take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Writer Talani Davis is my guest. In the town that you write about, and I suspect in the town you grew up in as well, there were a lot of boycotts once the civil rights movement got underway, boycotts of white businesses that that banned blacks from coming in or from sitting, you know, at the counter. What effects did that have on the black community? Did it bring you together? Did it strengthen the black community?
Oh, the boycotts did a lot of things. Yes, it brought us together. I think it also brought out a lot of creative energy. People had to find creative solutions to some of the needs that were not being served because we were boycotting stores. I'm curious to this day what people did when they needed nails, mundane things like that. But as far as, like, for instance, we couldn't go to movies. And there were a lot of venues for seeing what were usually old movies. But there were block parties started around that time also. Lots of activities that never existed before. All of the youth groups at churches had many more dances in the summertime. I think partly because people were working together more closely on a day-to-day basis, and also to sort of keep people with a lot of restless energy from, you know, seeking other things to do at a time when there had been already very few places for young people to go.
What impact did the boycotts have on the white businesses?
I think the boycotts were a big shock to white businesses in southern towns. I don't think they'd ever sat down and figured out, as they would have today, what percentage of their shoppers were black people in town. They, by and large, were somewhere between 40% and 60% of the business. So very quickly, it had an immediate intense impact on daily business when black people stopped going in. And in my hometown, they lasted about a year. I know in North Carolina, there was one town that boycotted for 5 years before they had a serious negotiation. But in my hometown, the boycotts put people out of business very quickly, some of them.
So did the town really change?
The town changed totally. The main street of the town never came back. Businesses that left did not return, and smaller enterprises were bought up by chains and never reopened their doors. And people who wanted to stay in business had to move out to shopping centers. Because basically, business stopped, and the center of town began to fail. I think that was pretty much the model, too.
What do you think the permanent impact has been on you of that experience of having been chosen to integrate a school, although the school never went through with it, so you never had to follow through, but you were chosen, you were observed, and you were preparing yourself for it?
The permanent impact of that was to give me a fairly bad attitude about the whole idea. And by that, I did try to write about this in the book, but by that I mean that the unstated question at hand in the integration situation was, were these kids good enough to be in a school with a mix of every kind of white student that might have lived in my hometown? And the assumption was that we were not as smart as the least intelligent white kid in that school. And it gave me this notion that, in a sense, a lot of people are raised with, that people are always measuring you, and as a black person, you have to go in and do better. But it gave me a bad attitude about that, that made me very competitive, but at the same time ingrained in me a notion that I had to prove nothing. I do not have to prove that I'm a human being. And maybe some people come to that later in life when they get into adulthood and they realize they don't have to explain themselves to anyone or defend themselves. But I knew I was a human being when I was 10, and when it was questioned when I was 12, it brought a certain anger to me that I'm still dragging around, I think.
So you knew you were a human being when you were 10. What happened when you were 10?
Well, I'm saying by that time, I had been raised in an environment where I had all the possibilities of any human being. So by the time the question was raised with me, whether I was as good as somebody I'd never set eyes on in my life, it wasn't a question to me. But it really made me wonder about the world I lived in where they were asking the question. And I guess my question was, well, who's asking? You know, who is that? Who wants to know?
So this idea of that you don't have to prove anything to anyone, how did that affect you in later years?
Oh, it affected me in bad ways and good. I when I went to college, I did voter registration my freshman year when I maybe should have been going to class. And if I got called in about it, I would say it's just as important to me to do voter registration as go to your class. I don't have to prove to you that I can make it through this school. When I went to Barnard, a fairly large proportion of the black women in my class were put on a program to take 6 years to get through the school. They were not asked if they would like to do this, but they were assumed not to be able to do it in the normal way, and they were given three classes instead of five. And I was not one of those, but they did want to know what I was doing with my time in the way a parent would, and I had a bad attitude about it because I knew I could handle the work there and I would be fine, you know. So I would get into conflict with them, perhaps more than the next student, because I had some sense that I was dealing with a hostile environment that was asking that question again. You know, that's how I reacted to it. When I came there, I had studied French for 8 years, and they asked me to be tested and to start in French 1 or 2 or something. And my response was, put me in the last year and let me flunk it. Because I knew I could make it, but I knew the institution would ask the question. And so I wasn't totally cooperative with the institution's idea of who I was supposed to be. And so it gave me what I would call a bad attitude, or a slight, you know, a rebellious attitude and a certain arrogance. And, I don't know that all of that was useful to me, but I think that really stemmed from my childhood experiences.
Tolani Davis, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Tolani Davis is the author of the new novel, 1959. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer is in New Hampshire, and she's joining us now from NPR's election headquarters there to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, will you be broadcasting live tonight from New Hampshire?
I will be live in New Hampshire. Robert Siegel will be on deck in Washington. But we're leading the program with a story from Haiti. Alan Tomlinson went into the interior to check out rumors of oppression in rural Haiti, the burning of a pro-Aristide village, and got into very great personal danger and was very nearly lost his life. It's an extraordinary account. We also will be covering from here what's happened with Governor Clinton, the aftermath, and a story about a beautiful rural New Hampshire town.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Director Curtis Hanson has quietly been making thrillers for years. His last two, The Bedroom Window and Bad Influence, got a smattering of good reviews and then flopped. His latest, The Hand That Rocks the Cradle, is a different story. It's turning out to be the first big hit of 1992. Film critic Stephen Schiff went to see what all the fuss was about.
Actually, there's nothing new in The Hand That Rocks the Cradle. Nothing new, that is, except the audience. This is an evil nanny story. And like all the other evil nanny or evil governess stories, it's part of an even more populist genre. It's a house invader picture. The kind that upsets us because it's about how someone wicked inveigles himself into your privacy and proceeds to destroy you. Maybe the most famous example is Gaslight. In The Hand That Rocks the Cradle, Claire Bartel, played by Annabella Sciorra, has a dreamboat husband and a big, terrific house, and she's pregnant with her second child. Claire has been working part-time at a local greenhouse. Now she wants to build and develop a greenhouse of her own. She's going to need a nanny. But what she's going to get is the nanny from hell. Peyton, played by Rebecca De Mornay, has lost her own family, and now she wants to take over Claire's. And Peyton's good at it. What's fun about The Hand That Rocks the Cradle is watching the little ruses and tricks by which Peyton wins the family's trust, and then little by little robs Claire of her confidence and security. By the time Claire's daughter, Emma, gets mad at her mom and snuggles into bed with the new nanny, Peyton has developed a master plan.
But your mommy wasn't mean like mine.
I didn't have a mommy. She died when I was very little.
Your mommy died? Then who took care of you?
I had to take care of myself.
Peyton, if something happens to my mommy, would you take care of me?
Of course I would. And your daddy, too. I'd take care of all of you.
Rebecca De Mornay could pass for Hillary Clinton's little sister, but that doesn't stop her from seeming to be evil incarnate. She's become a terrific actress, if a little cold. And when she wants to, she can bare her fangs like a rodent and scare the bejesus out of you. She gets more beautiful in this movie as Annabella Sciorra gets mousier, and that's all part of the plan. The trouble is the movie doesn't follow through. If the filmmakers had really wanted to get under your skin, they should have had Claire's dreamboat husband fall head over heels for Peyton, which he doesn't. Or they should have added a drop or two of malice to the Madonna-like figure of Claire. A bit of moral ambiguity can do worlds of good for even the most formulaic thriller. As it is, The Hand That Rocks the Cradle is just a well-oiled good versus evil machine, with a naggingly unpleasant subtext. After all, if Claire had stayed home and kept the apron strings on instead of trying to be, you know, fulfilled, then none of the horrors that followed would have happened. Unfortunately, I think it's that subtext that's made this movie a hit. It's a 20th century marketing law. Address the baby boom, and ye shall reap the rewards. That baby boom is now on its second child, is now dependent on two incomes, and is now full of women facing worrisome decisions about relinquishing control at home in order to get back into the job market. The nanny industry, meanwhile, is completely unregulated, and there have been scary incidents, even murders. The Hand That Rocks the Cradle isn't terribly good, but it's efficient enough. Efficient enough to make trouble for the rest of the year's films, in fact. See it, and you may hesitate the next time you want to spend an evening at the movies and leave the kids with a sitter.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Our show is produced by Fred Landerl, Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Roberta Shurrock, with Joan Tuohy and Sue Weinstein. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, is it better to have loved and lost than to have never loved at all? We celebrate Valentine's Day by reading romance comics of the 40s and 50s with Michael Barson, a trash culture maven. Also, we talk with Gay Talese about his new book, A Family History. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.